So in a way, this talk tonight is introducing, is partly to introduce a series of talks that are coming up. And that series of talks is four talks on what are called the Sangraha Vastus. So the Sangraha Vastu is the means of unification of the Sangha. And it's part, the means of unification of the Sangha, dana, kindly speech, beneficial activity and exemplification. And they're part of the skillful means of the Bodhisattva. So part of the seventh paramita, as I was saying earlier. So I don't know if you were doing the exercise that I suggested at the beginning to reflect on the verses of the puja as practices. If you were, you might have got some inkling of the practice of the Bodhisattva in the lead up to what's known as the awakening mind or the arising of the bodhicitta, or whatever way you want to talk about it. Anyone on the spiritual path who works on themselves, so through things like confession and rejoicing and so on, they work on themselves through communication, through meditation, through all the different practices we do, going on retreats and so on. And by working in yourself, you overcome all of the internal conflicts, and to some degree you start to see through all the things that hold you back, such as restless wanting something, or ill will or hatred or whatever, or various delusions about what's going to make you happy or what's going to fulfill your life and so on. We've got loads of delusions, too many to go into. All of those. So gradually, as you practice, you're overcoming all of that, and also overcoming various fears, because fear is a big part. Well, fear is part of delusion in a way, but it's a big thing that people encounter on the spiritual path. Whether it's fear of fear just in the sense of anxiety about doing things, or fear of the unknown, or fear of what's going to happen if they let go of their usual supports in terms of the usual things they desire and so on. So moving through all of that, eventually on the path, and not necessarily that far in a way, come to a point where you realize that the spiritual practice is not just about yourself, because you've overcome enough of things that are focused on yourself, your own fears and cravings and hatreds and so on. If you overcome enough of that and you expand out a bit beyond normal self-centeredness, beyond normal egotism and so on, you realize that actually the spiritual path is not just about me, it's about something more than that. It's much more expansive, it's much more outreaching than that. And that realization, in a way, is akin to the arising of the bodhicitta, because that's what the arising of the bodhicitta is about. It's about seeing that actually the spiritual path is not about me alone. It's not an egotistical venture, basically. It's a much more altruistic and compassionate venture. So it's about me and others. Yeah, that's what the arising of the bodhicitta is about. It's about seeing that, and seeing that very deeply, so that all your practice becomes in that kind of way. It becomes about me and others, not just about me. So the bodhisattva is said to be someone who's practicing to gain enlightenment for the sake of self and others. Yeah. So the bodhisattva is aiming to attain higher states of consciousness, not just for his or her own sake, not just for the sake of some kind of hedonistic buzz, as it were, but also, and maybe primarily, for the sake of all beings. So it's this outward-looking, other-regarding attitude. That's the hallmark of the bodhisattva. That's the bodhisattva path. And that's what the arising of the bodhicitta is about. That's what the awakening heart is about. The awakening of the bodhisattva. And as I said earlier, the bodhisattva path is sometimes laid out in terms of the four reminders. So the four reminders are to get, as it were, get the juices flowing, get the energy flowing. So they're reminding you, this is a precious opportunity. You've got this life, you've got your health, you've got your wits about you, you can practice. So this precious opportunity. Then it reminds you that you're going to die. That's the second reminder. So you've got this precious opportunity, but it's not going to last forever. So that's the second reminder. And the third reminder is the law of karma. If you act skillfully, then things will follow from that, beneficial things will follow from that, for your sake and for the sake of others. The benefits will flow out, as it were, from skillful action. And then the last reminder is the reminder of the faults of samsara. In other words, it's reminding you that all those things you might be craving or restlessly wanting in your life, they're not going to give you lasting happiness. So that those are the four reminders, and they're meant to motivate us. They're meant to motivate us to practice, to actually move along the path. And then the practice of the Anuttara Puja, the what we talk about as the Sevenfold Puja, is one way of looking at the practices. It's not so much practice, it's almost like the aspiration. It's the kind of aspiration to actually practice. So it's the aspiration to go for refuge and to do what is required in terms of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. So what's required are things like confession, things like being receptive, entreaty and supplication, being receptive to teaching, rejoicing in the fact that we have the opportunity, rejoicing in the fact that we have opportunities like a Buddhist center and a Sangha and teachings and so on, rejoicing in that, and rejoicing in the fact that enlightenment is a possibility. And then, of course, there's the out of that coming this altruistic rush, as it were, of energy to actually give to others and so on. After that, the practices that come after that are the perfections. So the bodhisattva, and it's worth noting that compassion is not one of the perfections. So the perfections are dana, ethics, kshanti, forbearance, patience, energy in pursuit of the good, virya, meditation and wisdom. Compassion is not one of the perfections because compassion has already arisen, the arising of the bodhicitta. So this is the transformation of the bodhisattva based on the arising of this urge to practice for the sake of all. Yeah? So out of that comes this the perfections. And there are, as I said, not just six perfections, but ten perfections, in fact, in some renditions of the perfections. I've written down somewhere what the other ones. Oh yeah, the other perfections, just for sake of completion, the seventh perfection is skillful means, as I said. The eighth is the perfection of the vow or aspiration. The ninth is the perfection of spiritual power. And the tenth is the perfection of knowledge. I'm not going to go into those tonight. So this seventh perfection is what we're dealing with tonight. And that might seem like a long way along the path. You might still be back at the four reminders thinking, that's good enough for me, or that's as far as I'm likely to get. But actually, so we've come through a long way through the perfections, and now we're at the seventh perfection, which is all about how the bodhisattva is perfecting the ability to communicate the Dharma, the ability to communicate what has been gained through practice. Yeah, and although it may seem a long way, actually, well, what I'm trying to do tonight is to make it very relevant to us, because, of course, all of these practices, they're not just advanced practices, they're also basic practices, because every practice is there from the beginning, just as the goal of all practice is there from the beginning. So right from the beginning, the very first practice we talk about probably is something like generosity, but in generosity is contained, as it were, the goal of great compassion. So the practices are never disconnected from each other or disconnected from the goal. They're all connected. Yeah. So the seventh perfection is something that we can be practicing because it runs through all of our practice. So skillful means is upaya kusala. So kusala, you've probably heard it before. Kusala karma, skillful action. Upaya kusala is skillful means. And upaya is translated as something like means or expedient or approach. So it's simply, it's just an ordinary word meaning a way of achieving something. And it's used in all sorts of contexts, not necessarily skillful ones. Kusala means skillful in the sense of ethically skillful. So actions coming out of love and generosity and wisdom. But in this context, skillful also means something else. It means skillful in the sense of the most effective and appropriate means. So it's if we take these words together, upaya kusala, what they mean is a means of communicating the Dharma that's expedient. Yeah, it's expedient or it's... it's expedient in the sense of it's appropriate. And it's skillful in the sense of being both ethical and effective. Yeah, it's ethical and it's effective. Sometimes skillful means is talked about as being some unconventional or unusual way of communicating the Dharma. And it could be that, but it's not. That's not the main thing about upaya kusala. The main thing is that it's appropriate, effective, and ethically skillful. So upaya kusala, skillful means, can be looked at in terms of the four Sangraha Vastus and in terms of the four what are called Pratisamvids. So the four Sangraha Vastus are the four means of unifying the Sangha. And the four Pratisamvids are four analytical knowledges. I'm going to go into those. So the four Sangraha Vastus, the four means of unifying the Sangha, this is what the four other speakers are going to explore over the coming weeks. So dana or generosity is the first one. Kindly speech is the second one. Beneficial activity is the third one. And exemplification is the fourth one. So these four are skillful means. They're means of communicating the Dharma that are appropriate and skillful in the sense of being both ethical and effective. Yeah. So just to say what's happening for those of you who may be coming along in future weeks, Dharmanatha will talk about dana next week. Then a couple of weeks later, Amritavani, who's sitting here, will look at kindly speech. The week after that, Chittamodini will do something on listening deeply. And then on the 17th of October, Viryajyoti will talk about beneficial activity. And the last talk on the end of October will be Kula Priya, talking about exemplification. So we've got this feast of Dharma talks coming up. I'm not going to say anything more about the Sangraha Vastus because I don't want to take anything away from the speakers as well. Actually, that's not completely true. I will say something. But what I want to look into this evening is the four Pratisamvids, the four analytical knowledges. Those of you who've done Mitra study and things like that will know that this comes up in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha in Bhante's lecture on skillful means, which I think is called On Being All Things to All Men. So in that lecture, he talks about the four Sangraha Vastus. And he also talks about the four Pratisamvids briefly. And I've never heard anyone give a talk about them, so I thought I'd have a go. And actually, I've regretted it. But because it's not an easy thing to talk about. But I'm going to do my best to give you something about the four pratisamvids, or the four analytical knowledges. So this phrase, analytical knowledge, doesn't tell us very much. It's actually not very helpful. So what these four, what they really are about is training in the best way to communicate the Dharma. So Buddhism began when the Buddha successfully communicated the Dharma to one person. That first person to get it, as it were, to really understand what the Buddha was communicating, that was Kundanya. And that moment when Kundanya understood, is sometimes referred to the setting in motion of the wheel of the Dharma. And the wheel of the Dharma, you could say, has been rolling ever since, down the generations to us. Without Kundanya, there would be no Buddhism. Somebody had to get it. It had to be communicated to at least one other person, and that was Kundanya. Perhaps we should be called Kundanyists, not Buddhists, because he was the one who set Buddhism in motion. And this point in the history of Buddhism is often symbolized by the wheel, the eight-spoked wheel, the spokes representing the Eightfold Path. So this point, this is the origin of Buddhism. And it's such a key point in Buddhist history, as it were, this successful communication of the Dharma, that wheel of the Dharma, that Dharma chakra, is often used to symbolize Buddhism, just in the same way that the cross symbolizes Christianity or the crescent moon symbolizes Islam. We've got the Dharma chakra, so that's Buddhism. So anyway, these four pratisamvids, or analytical knowledges, they're about what the bodhisattva does to become a supreme communicator of the Dharma, like a super Dharma teacher, yeah, supercharged Dharma teacher. But the first thing to note is that the communication of the Dharma is not just about verbal communication. It's not about giving talks, yeah. It's not just about verbal communication. It's worth noting that that three of the Sangharavastus, the means of unification, are about doing rather than speaking. They're about doing, not about speaking. They're about dana, beneficial activity, and exemplification. They're about doing, not speaking. So the most important communication of the Dharma is actually practicing it. That practicing the Dharma is the best communication of the Dharma. And only by practicing the Dharma can we come to embody it to some degree. And it's only by becoming loving, by becoming generous, by becoming mindful and so on, that our verbal communication has sufficient congruency and coherence to positively influence other people. So the Dhammapada says, first establish yourself in what is good, then advise others. So that's good advice. First establish yourself in what is good, then advise others. So anyway, assuming that we're practicing ethics, meditation, study, friendship, going on retreat, then all of us have something to communicate. And we may communicate through our actions, through our example, or verbally, or in some other way, perhaps. And if we are practicing, then what we have to communicate, what we can communicate, is very valuable. And it can even be life-saving for some people. There are many people in our order and in our movement who say that the Dharma literally saved their lives, yeah? In other words, that they were on a suicidal path or a destructive path. And the Dharma literally saved their lives. So the four Sangharavastus, which I'm not talking about, they tell us that generosity, kindly speech, beneficial activity and exemplification are key ways to communicate the values and principles of Buddhism. and to in that way to contribute to the creation of Sangha. The four Pratisamvids go a bit further, and they suggest some very specific things to work on in order to be, as I said, a super communicator of the Dharma, a bodhisattva. So the first thing we need is experience. And the first Pratisamvid is called Dharma Pratisamvid, which can be translated as knowledge of principles. But what it's really getting at is that we need to have some experience of what we're trying to communicate in order for our communication to have that congruency that we need. It needs to be based in experience. The Buddha communicated his enlightenment out of the experience of awakening. We can communicate from our experience of being ethical, or our experience of meditating, or our experience of going on retreat. And often, as I said, we have much more to share with other people than we realize. We might think that we're not really meditating, we're struggling to concentrate or something like that. Or we might think we're not very mindful, or that we're always falling short of the ethical precepts, or that we don't understand the concepts of the Dharma or whatever. And maybe all of that is true. Maybe it's all true to some extent at least. But nevertheless, there'll always be someone who has less experience who may benefit from what you have to give. So if you have tried to meditate, you will have something to say about meditation. If you've ever been on retreat, you'll be able to give a first-hand account of what it's like to be on retreat. Yeah? So this Pratisamvid is encouraging us to practice so that we can be of benefit to others, so that we will have some authentic experience to share. And of course, when I say communicate, it sometimes this just communicates itself. The mere fact that we practice transforms us to some degree, and therefore that communicates just through our behavior, through our being, and so on. It communicates. The second Pratisamvid is known as Artha Pratisamvid. Artha meaning meaning, so knowledge of meaning. And this is about knowing the conceptual formulations of the Dharma so that you have a framework for communicating. So this is encouraging the study of the suttas and the sutras, the study of all the commentaries that are available to us and so on. Now, we're in the fortunate position that we don't have to struggle through the Diamond Sutra or the Sutra of Golden Light or whatever. We can read Bhante's explanations, Bhante's commentaries. Sometimes it's good to look at the original texts after we've read a commentary so that we can learn for ourselves how to approach these texts. And of course, also by studying the Dharma, we can equip ourselves to communicate about things that we have no direct experience of. So it might seem like I'm contradicting myself. Earlier I was saying we need experience in order to communicate. But we can also communicate about things that we don't have direct experience of. What we have experience of is of studying them. Yeah, and we can make that clear in some way that actually it's not a direct experience, it's something that we've studied. So this Pratisamvid, as I say, is encouraging us to study the Dharma, to have familiarity with the conceptual formulations such as the Eightfold Path, the Five Spiritual Faculties, the Three Lakshanas, and so on. The reason I can give talks and lead study and so on is because I've read and studied Bhante Sangharakshita's commentaries and clarifications intensively and extensively. And I just want to say here that in my view, if we're to practice effectively within the Tri Ratna tradition, we need a thorough and deep knowledge of Bhante's elucidation of the Dharma. We need to become experts in it. So people become experts in all sorts of things. I'm sure there are people in this room who are experts in something. Yeah? People become experts in all sorts of things. And why not become an expert in Bhante's elucidation of the Dharma? Being able to quote lots of things from there, being able to connect different teachings and so on. I think that's a kind of crucial aspect of our bodhisattva practice, is to become experts in Bhante's elucidation of the Dharma. Because I've often encountered people involved with Sri Ratna who think they have a thorough knowledge of Bhante's teachings because they've done Mitra study or other study and whatever. But my own experience is that you have to return again and again to the same texts to allow the teachings to go deeper and to affect you more deeply, and also to come to them with different understanding as the years go by, as you progress on the path. As you come back to something maybe that seems really simple, like the Eightfold Path or something like that, but you come back to it with a different perspective, and it goes deeper. And of course, even after, I think it's 33 years or something I've been doing this, I've not read all of the seminars that Bhante has given. I was saying to Claire the other day that I think there are many buried treasures in Bhante's seminars, like termas, like Padmasambhava's termas, waiting to be unearthed at some point. And if we don't engage with our own teacher's teachings, then what we're doing in effect is we are deciding to be our own teacher. Yeah, so we're deciding follow our own path and base our path on our own preferences, as it were. Well, what is leading us from our own lesser perspective, something like that. And that's really not conducive to spiritual growth. It's a kind of consumerist approach to the Dharma, picking and choosing according to your preferences. So this is Artha Pratisamvit. It's knowledge of meaning. It's knowing the teachings. Knowing the teachings means knowing the teachings of the Buddha, and in our case, I think it means knowing the teachings of Bhante Sangharakshita. So having mastered the first two pratisamvits, you've got experience and you've got a whole framework for expressing that verbally, and you're also expressing it in other ways because you've got experience, because you're embodying it to some degree. So having done that, having knowledge of the concepts and ideas, having experience of the Dharma, we then come to the third pratisamvit, which is nirukti pratisamvit. And this is rendered as something like knowledge of words or knowledge of etymology. And this is about being able to communicate in the most effective and intelligible way. So it's not enough to have studied the Dharma. We also need to be able to speak about it in a way that effectively conveys the meaning that we want to convey. So it's important to have a sense of what words mean. That might involve having some idea about the origins of words, the etymology of words. But I think it's actually more important to have a sense of the provisional nature of words. It's as if all words are fingers pointing at the moon. All words are trying to give expression to something that is not the words themselves, and therefore they're signposts. All words are signposts, pointers. And having a sense of this kind of provisional nature of words means that we don't rely too much on one way of expressing things, expressing what we want to say. So, for instance, we're continually using metaphors and images in our speech. And it's good to have some awareness of this so that we can vary the images and the metaphors that we use. So that's the first thing, just having a sense of that words are quite provisional. They're not the thing itself. Yeah? And the second thing is that we need to be aware in relation to words of the tendency to be literal-minded. So it's very tempting to take things literally and allow the words and the concepts to rule the direction of our thinking and even our whole outlook on life. So in the arena of Dharma practice, we might be fond, for instance, of one particular metaphor. We might like to think of things in terms of depth, the metaphor of depth, of going deeper. Or we might like to think of things in terms of height, the metaphor of going higher, higher states of consciousness and so on. And if we're too literal-minded, we could get into a whole argument about ways of practicing and so on, just on the basis of the images evoked by these metaphors. Yeah? Because words evoke images. Words have kind of flavor to them. They have images to go with them. So we could get into a whole, tie ourselves in knots just on the basis of the images evoked by metaphors. So it's best for us to be aware of the provisional nature of words and the role that our imagination plays in interpreting words, yeah? Interpreting language. Whole cultures have been influenced adversely by literal-mindedness. People have been persecuted and wars have been fought because of literal-mindedness. There's a little quote from Kamala Shila, a talk he gave on the Eightfold Path. He says, literalism means taking words at their face value instead of recognizing their metaphorical resonance. Literalism happens when we stop trying to understand, when we think we know, and start going through the motions. It's characteristic of merely external religion. Now, of course, there's another danger with words, and that is that we don't take them literally enough when they're meant literally. Yeah? We may sometimes try to avoid the impact of a teaching by trying to give a metaphorical slant to it, when actually it's intended quite literally. Our minds are wonderfully flexible, and usually flexible in the service of our very own ego empire building. Yeah? So we could take the idea of a path literally, as in the Noble Eightfold Path, when actually it's intended as a helpful image. You could say there's no path. It's an image. Yeah? Or you are the path, or whatever. But if you take another teaching, take, for instance, the teaching in the Dhammapada. It says, not by hatred are hatreds ever pacified here in the world. They are pacified by love. This is the eternal law. Others do not realize that we are all heading for death. Those who do realize will compose their quarrels. So that's to be taken literally, not metaphorically. But I guess if, for instance, we had not composed our quarrels, we might not want to accept that we are among those who do not realize that we're all heading for death. And therefore, we might be tempted to try to soften what the Buddha is saying by some rationalization. So anyway, the point I'm making is that when it comes to communicating the Dharma, it's important that we try not to get caught up in misunderstanding simply because we don't understand the words sufficiently or because we get too attached to particular metaphors or become blind to the principles behind the words. So that's what this Pratisamvid, Nirukti Pratisamvid, that's what it's about. And it's important, this knowledge of words, it's important both for understanding and for communicating the Dharma. Then the last Pratisamvid is called Pratibhana Pratisamvid, which can be rendered as knowledge of courage. Of course, it's not really about having knowledge of what courage is, it's about actually having courage, having confidence. It means that when we're communicating the Dharma, it's good to be prepared to communicate it at a time when it's needed. So that, again, implies being very familiar with concepts and ideas and stories and images from Buddhism. And it also implies practicing communicating so that you can become more skilled at it. In a way, this is what our study groups are about, our Mitra study groups and so on. What you're doing in those groups, partly, is you're practicing communicating the Dharma, because you're trying to communicate at some point your understanding of the traditional teachings. So it's given you practice in communicating your understanding and blending your experience with the traditional formulations of the Dharma. And that's why one reason why it's really valuable to study with others, because it's not just a learning of concepts, it's also a practice in communication. It's a practice in sharpening our wits and making us familiar with the best ways of expressing ideas. And it also shows us, of course, when we're failing to make ourselves understood, which means that we need more practice, yeah? So this Pratisamvid, knowledge of courage as it's called, is about developing the skill to be able to communicate with promptitude, with clarity, with intelligence, with wit and so on, when the need arises. And of course, lack of confidence is something many of us will be familiar with and hampers us in all sorts of ways. And in particular, it can of course hamper our ability to share our experience of the Dharma with others. But of course, the Dharma is the greatest gift we can give, and it would be a great shame if we didn't train ourselves to be able to communicate well. So we shouldn't just think, I am lacking in confidence, and that's the end of the story, or I am whatever, I'm anxious or fearful or whatever, and that's the end of the story. If we're lacking in confidence, we need to find ways to overcome that, yeah? Ways to face our fears and to liberate ourselves from our fears and become capable of giving others the gift of the Dharma. That's the path of the Bodhisattva. Now, the only way that I've found of overcoming fear, because I actually experienced a lot of fear, and especially fear about being in front of a group of people speaking. And the only way I have found of overcoming fear that works is to face the fear. That's the only way I've found it works. There's the book title out there, isn't it? Feel the Fear and Do It Anyway. And that seems like that's the remedy, basically. That's how you do it. So I was a very, well, I still am possibly, shy and introverted person by nature. And by inclination. And for me, it's been a constant practice. It's been constant practice that's enabled me to become more confident and at ease in public situations. It is something that I still have to consciously work with. Yeah. If I were to go with my inclinations, I would say no to giving talks and things like that. The other thing that gave me confidence was being ordained. Yeah? I experienced that as a major affirmation by people I looked up to and respected. Yeah? So, yes, I guess I'm encouraging you to face your fears and, well, maybe just take seriously any affirmation you receive from others. Yeah? Take it seriously. That way you build confidence. Because, of course, sometimes if we don't have confidence, if people say something, rejoice on us in some ways, we don't quite take it on board because we don't fully believe it. So maybe taking on board any affirmation you get from others. So the Bodhisattva is a Buddhist who's training to become an exemplar and communicator of the Dharma. And these Sangharavastus and Pratisamvids give an indication of the areas that we need to train in. And in the traditional Mahayana teachings, the ability to teach the Dharma is seen as a very high attainment. That's the ability to teach the Dharma perfectly. The four Pratisamvids are mastered at the level of the ninth bhumi of the Bodhisattva, which is just on the threshold of enlightenment. That's when the Bodhisattva is ready to teach, according to the Mahayana. But we don't need to expect ourselves to be perfect. The perfection comes from practice and from making mistakes. Yeah? It's important to make mistakes. Making mistakes is an important part of the Bodhisattva practice. Yeah? The alternative, of course, is to not do anything in order to avoid making mistakes. So if we act or if we speak, we are likely sometimes to make mistakes. And the importance of mistakes is that they're a vital part of the learning process. Yeah? If we hold ourselves back from doing things because of fear of making mistakes, then, as Bhante puts it, we could become someone with a great future behind them. Yeah? So in the mandala of the five Buddhas, which I hope you're all familiar with, it's possible to see a progression of practices related to the Sangharavastus and the Pratisamvids. So we begin with Akshobhya and his mirror-like wisdom, which reminds us of the need to be objective. So if we're communicating, it's important not to rely entirely on our own subjective experience or our own interpretation of experience. We need to be attuned to reality, be as attuned as possible to reality, as objective as possible. So that's similar to what Artha Pratisamvid is about, knowledge of the meaning as taught by the Buddha. And there's somewhere in one of the Pure Land Suttas, it says that if you have a big experience in meditation, you know, like a major experience, it says, when you stop meditating, be sure to check your own experience against the scriptures. Don't rely on your own interpretation of your own experience. Check it against the scriptures to make sure it's got this objective element to it, that it's of the nature of reality. Then we have Ratnasambhava, and his association with generosity, which of course is one of the Sangharavastus. In a few weeks' time, I'm going to do a Ratnasambhava puja here after we've heard from Dharmanatha. Then Amitabha reminds us that we need to go deeper and experience the nature of reality for ourselves. And that's what the first Pratisamvid is about, Dharma Pratisamvid. Then Amoghasiddhi encourages fearlessness, which is what the knowledge of courage, Pratibhana Pratisamvid, is about. And then sitting at the center of the mandala is the Buddha Vairochana, who you have in the shrine tonight. And the Vairochana, his mudra, is the teaching mudra. And usually what's at the center of the mandala is what the whole mandala is about. And this is indicating that what is represented by all the Buddhas culminates in the teaching of the Dharma. There is no enlightenment that is not shared, because compassion is innate to the awakened consciousness. And the greatest act of compassion is to give the gift of the Dharma, which, as I said, is the greatest gift. When the Buddha had 60 disciples who shared his understanding and experience of the Dharma, he gathered them together and he said, "Go ye now, bhikkhus, and wander for the gain of the many, for the welfare of the many, out of compassion for the world, for the good, for the gain, for the welfare of gods and men. Let not two of you go the same way. preach, O bhikkhus, the doctrine which is glorious in the beginning, glorious in the middle, glorious at the end, in the spirit and in the letter. Proclaim a consummate, perfect and pure life of holiness. There are beings whose mental eyes are covered by scarcely any dust, but if the doctrine is not preached to them, they cannot attain salvation. So this is what the whole Bodhisattva is about, and this was there at the beginning of Buddhism as well as now. It's the path to the most perfect compassion, a compassion which endeavours to cure the sickness of humanity, not by assuaging the symptoms, but by going to the root cause and by means of the Dharma helping people to liberate themselves from the causes of suffering.